welcome to the 2024 Iowa City Book Festival, presented by Iowa City UNESCO City of Literature, which I'm a board member of proudly. We would like to thank the sponsors and partners that made this event possible. So the City of Iowa City, the University of Iowa, the Iowa City Public Library, Prairie Lights, Iowa Public Radio, the Graduate Hotel, and Think Iowa City. Support is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and the Iowa Arts Council, which exists within the Iowa Economic Development Authority. Between events, be sure to visit the Book Fair and Merge, which is at 136 South Dubuque Street, right next door to the public library on the Penn Mall. The vast majority of the book festival events are offered without charge, but they are not free. Please consider donating to the City of Literature by visiting iowacitybookfestival.org and clicking on support. Today, we are at the panel discussion on politics. In this panel, writers will discuss how the current political landscape affects their work and the role politics plays in their writing. Now, please welcome our moderator, Zachary Oren Smith.
Thank you so much. Not necessary, but I appreciate it. Welcome to the Book Fest's politics panel. I'm Starting Lines chief politics correspondent Zachary Oren Smith. I want to take a second to thank the festival and the writers for joining us. In 1995, in Ur-Fascism, Umberto Eco wrote, "Even though political regimes can be overthrown and ideologies can be criticized and disowned, behind a regime and its ideology, there's always a way of thinking and feeling, a group of cultural habits, of obscure instincts, and unfathomable drives." Today, we have a panel of writers who deal both explicitly with political ideology and also implicitly with the lives we live within them. And briefly, let's meet our panel. Hatice Acegüz is a fiction writer and poet and editor from Germany. They've written a collection of short stories and poetry and are currently working on a debut novel exploring the rise of fascism in modern Germany. I hope to get a little bit to that novel today. Ari Berman is Mother Jones National Voting Rights Correspondent and Reporting Fellow for Type Media Center. He is a National Book Critics Circle finalist and frequent commentator on NPR and MSNBC. He wrote this year's Minority Rule, The Right-Wing Attack on the Will of the People and the Fight to Resist It. Amanda Jones, also from the South, is an American librarian and anti-censorship advocate. She's the president, was the president of the Louisiana Association of School Librarians and is the author of That Librarian. She's been an important voice in the debate over what books children are and are not allowed to read. Nina Lohman is the publisher of Brink, a literary journal of hybrid writing. She directs programming for Iowa City's Mission Creek Festival. And then Natalie Goldberg is a poet, teacher, writer, and painter. Goldberg teaches writing workshops based on methods from her 1986 book, Writing Down the Bones. And Goldberg, I want to start with you. You're coming to us from a trip to Montgomery, Alabama. I wanted if you'd briefly kind of describe what you were doing down there.
I've always cared a lot about civil rights, and I remember when I was a kid, I wanted to join something. Is this on? Can you sure hear me? I wanted to join something with civil rights, but I didn't know what, and I was very meek, and we were living on a split level in a split level development on Long Island, and I knew my parents would go berserk if I asked them. So I let it go, but in my heart of hearts, I never forgot it. And I was very driven to pass on writing practice, which was, I'd practiced Zen for 12 years, and Katagiri Roshi and I put it together, how you can learn. I wanted to write, but I couldn't figure out how. And really, the writing is about the mind. You know, otherwise pen, paper, and the human mind. I know some of you use computers, but it's still the human mind. Anyway, I was driven with that. But now that I've stepped back since COVID, I went, I've donated money for a long time to the Southern Poverty Law Center. And I went down, they invited me down for a conference in Montgomery, Alabama. And when I went there, I went to, I don't know if you know Brian Stevenson. He wrote Just Mercy. He wrote the book and he also did the movie. And I remember seeing the movie 10 years ago. I'm thinking, I can't touch this. It's too painful. But I finally stepped forward. I went down to Montgomery and I saw what he was doing. He has a museum for enslaved people, for the history of enslaved people, all the way up from coming across the ocean all the way to incarceration now. And then another museum, people call it the Lynch Museum, but it's not, and it's outside, and it's a killer. I mean, I just thought, who is this person? Who are they engaging to develop this work? It's the best stuff I've seen any place. And since then, he's done a sculpture garden. He bought 17 acres on the Alabama River. And the Alabama River is where they would buy enslaved people and then send them downriver. And that expression, sold you down the river, comes from there. And so I thought, I'm going to bring a group down here. No more going to Asia and Japan and studying Zen over in Japan. I'm taking them here. And I knew to pick people. I invited people that could handle it because it's very raw. And I just brought a group down and I've just come back. And please go down. Mm-hmm. And the group, I'll say one other thing, was I rented a conference room, and every day at 4, we would meet and talk about what we saw. And we went around and I said, okay, who would you bring here? And everybody said, oh, I'll bring my parents, oh, I'll bring my children. You know, and I'm sick of that, frankly. Since COVID, all people do is talk about their family. Mm-hmm. And I'm just sick of that. I didn't ever think that. I had to get as far away from my family as I could. And suddenly everybody wants to be with their family. So after we went around with 18 people, I thought, Natalie, behave yourself. Don't yell at them. So I just said quietly, if I brought my family, none of you would be here. So it was sort of like a haiku. They had to take a leap. And it's wonderful because they got it. They got the message. And they really are spreading the word because we need to spread the word. Germany has done a beautiful job and really looked, not everybody, but some people and some cities have looked at what happened in the Holocaust. But the U.S. has not really, we're rich on somebody else's back. And I know you think I was just a polite Buddhist who, but it isn't like that. Okay.
In 2003, you told The Sun in an interview that one reason we're so quick to drop bombs is that we see the world as abstract and removed. If everyone in our country had a regular writing practice and a true relationship to their mind, we wouldn't be as likely to swallow slogans and be ruled by fear. I was 9 at the time when this was written, and I might have agreed with you at that time. But I see many people caught up in the process of putting words to their feelings in comment sections on websites like the one I work for. And I don't get the sense that bombs are dropping at any less speed. Would you draw a distinction between what the kind of writing process that you imagine informing that belief, right? And kind of what we're seeing as the sort of like content explosion of this time?
Well, in 2003, I was very idealistic, and I practiced my ass off as a Zen person. I still believe in it all, but it doesn't mean that it happens. And what I meant by that is about being specific. And if what happens, the more we become abstract, the more they can drop bombs and we don't even know it. we have to pay attention. Mm-hmm. And part of paying attention is being specific. You know, just today, you have that beautiful quote, UNESCO quote, and then a group of two women were sitting there, and I asked, do you know about this quote? And they said, no. And I said, well, look at it. And then the next thing I said, what's behind you? They said, we know there's something behind us. I said, what is it? They said, we don't know. I said, look and be specific. Mm. I'm a real pain in the neck. You don't want to be around me. But it is really true. We need to wake up, mm-hmm. be specific, and see what's going on. Because if we don't see it, we can't even do anything about it. And I think that's what I meant, is people live in the abstract. Writing practice demands you to be specific. And it began for me with women, and women having a confidence in our experience mm-hmm. that even opening the refrigerator is valuable to write about, and our voices are valuable mm-hmm. enough. And we can stand up and we can speak. I think that's what I meant.
Thank you. Nina Lohman, I wanted to move to you. In your book, The Body Alone, you write a great deal about isolation experienced in chronic pain. This is a social symptom of a biological experience. Can you tell me about how that this isolation shapes or figures into your relationship with politics at this moment? We were talking a little bit about healthcare, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely. So the book that I wrote recently called The Body Alone, it chronicles my experience with chronic pain for the last like 17 years, kind of digging into different parts of that experience. And in the process of writing that book, which took 7 or 8 years, it really started as this personal story. I wanted to tell what was happening to me. I wanted to work my way through what I thought, what I felt, what I knew. And the more I read and the more I researched, it really became clear that what I thought was a singular experience, my own experience of feeling and being told that I have something called chronic daily headaches, which is exactly what it sounds like. Mm-hmm. And I was told by a lot of physicians that they didn't know what to do with me. They didn't know what caused it or what would make it go away or what would help or anything like that. And the more I read and talked with other people, the more I realized that it's absolutely not me. I'm not an anomaly. There are millions of people. Most of them are about my age. Most of them have female sex parts. And there was a point in writing this book that really turned from being my story to realizing that this is something that is political. This is something that is affecting everybody, not just me and my body. And there was actually one really specific moment that turned that corner for me. And it was in the research where I learned that it wasn't until 2016 that the National Institute of Health mandated that pain medication be tested on both male mice and female mice. Mm. Both men and women. And that was like 30 seconds ago. Like that was hardly a minute ago. And I can't believe how long I have been ingesting medication that has exclusively been tested on a body that does not reflect my own. So I think, yeah, Natalie, what you were just saying, be specific, pay attention, open our eyes, look around. Everything we do, everything that touches our body and touches what we do is political.
Thank you. Ari Berman, I want to move to you. Just this week, a Georgia judge struck down a state elections board's rule that would require a hand count of ballots on election night. We're just weeks away from a very important day. I hope all of you are registered to vote if you're for this election. Can you tell us a little bit about this decision by the judge and kind of why it's a big deal for those of us who may not be paying attention to what's
sure.
happening in Georgia?
And thank you for having me. And is the mic on?
Yeah, lean closer.
Okay. Huh? Yeah. Okay. Thank you for having me, and it's great to be with everyone on the panel. So, unlike I think probably some of the other writers who politics is a part of what they do, politics is what I do. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit of a different experience for me because I would like to get away from it, mm-hmm. And I can't because I cover voting rights and elections, and so I've been covering this issue for a long time. And when I started covering the issue of voting rights, I was mostly focused on restrictions on access to the ballot. And these are things that have been passed in Iowa in recent years, but lots of states around the country. So things that make it more difficult for people to be able to vote, whether it's restricting mail ballots or cutting back on early voting or deciding who is eligible to vote, things like that. What's really happened as a result of the 2020 election, though, ever since Trump tried to overturn the election, is we've been focused not just on restrictions on the front end of the process, but now restrictions on the back end of the process, meaning how elections are run, who's in charge of them, how are the ballots counted, how are elections certified. Those are things that we had really, with a few exceptions, not really been talking about prior to 2020. And I think Trump's attempt to overturn the election was very eye-opening for a lot of people, that there was a lot of vulnerabilities in our election system that we weren't aware of. And that even though Trump failed to overturn the election, he exposed a lot of vulnerabilities and he got a lot of people involved who believe the election was stolen and then got active in the election process. So Georgia is a very good example of that. Georgia has a state election board, and the election board members are appointed in part by the political parties and in part by members of the legislature. What the Georgia Republican Party and the Georgia legislature had done prior to 2020 is they had put reasonable Republicans on those boards who would certify election results. What they did after 2020 is they kicked off the Secretary of State who defended the election. They kicked him off the election board, and they put people who said the election was stolen on the election board. Mm. And this was very concerning because that board then issued the rules that county election boards would follow. And in a very short period of time, from basically August to September of this year, the board began passing all of these things that could delay the process. So things like a hand count of ballots on election night, which would take longer to count the ballots. Things like saying that counties must undertake what they called a reasonable inquiry before certifying the results without specifying what the inquiry would be. Things like saying you could have access to all documentation without spelling out what that meant. And remember, Trump went to Georgia in August and he praised the members of this election board by name. No one had ever really heard of that before, and talking about, you know, authoritarianism, that was a very authoritarian thing to do, to say that I am going to take an institution that was supposed to set fair rules and I'm going to make it basically an extension of the election denial movement. So the good news in Georgia is that multiple judges have since struck these rules down before the election. So it doesn't seem like they're going to be in place unless they are reinstated by a higher court there. But the concern is that these things aren't just happening in Georgia, right? They're happening in other states as well. And a lot of people with bad intentions are in charge of the voting process in some way or another in 2024 to the extent they weren't in 2020.
If you can say a little bit more, I don't think it's intuitive to someone who's not paying attention to the sort of back end of election law, or the laws running our elections, why a delay in time to certification would be a tremendous, tremendously impact kind of our experience of this election, kind of when we get that result. Can you say a little bit about
why
that's important?
One of the ways that Trump really weaponized disinformation in 2020 was he cast a lot of aspersions on how long it was taking to count votes. So, for example, he had a lead and then his lead disappeared in places like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania because it took longer to count ballots. And that was viewed as not just the normal process of counting ballots. It was viewed as some evidence of a nefarious conspiracy. Like they literally picked up the ballots from under the table and counted them for Biden. I mean, that's literally what they were saying. They counted them for Biden and they threw out all the Trump ballots. I mean, that's what people believe. And so any delay in counting ballots now becomes weaponized by Trump. And so if you get in a situation like Georgia, there's two things. There's the disinformation and the misinformation part of it, where he's going to say there's some evidence of conspiracy here, and he's going to get his supporters really riled up, which is very dangerous in light of the fact we had an insurrection at the Capitol last time. But also there's deadlines that states have to make. And this is another thing we learned in the last election. If you don't make those deadlines, it becomes very problematic. So, for example, the counties have to certify, and then it has to be certified statewide. And sometimes the legislature has to sign off. And sometimes the governor has to sign off. And Trump pressured all of those people, right, the last time. And what he wanted to do is he wanted to kick it to the House so that his own vice president would then try to overturn the results. Mike Pence refused to do that, but I think Trump is hoping something like that will happen again. And not to get too technical, but there's a somewhat obscure nightmare scenario that's embedded in our Constitution, which is that if there is no majority winner in the Electoral College, the election is thrown to the House of Representatives under the 12th Amendment. And it's chosen not by a majority of House members, but a majority of state House delegations. And Republicans have a majority in state House delegations because they've gerrymandered a lot of states like Wisconsin, and also places like Iowa, when I was growing up, which were very purple, have now become a lot more red. A lot of rural America has become a lot more red. So in Iowa and Louisiana and all these places. So if that happens, you could essentially have a situation, I'm not saying this is likely, but it's possible, in which Trump doesn't win the popular vote. He doesn't win the Electoral College. Republicans don't even control a majority of House members, but they're nonetheless are able to install Trump as president. I don't want to ruin everyone's Saturday afternoon. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but it's a possibility in terms of our Constitution.
Stakes are always important, so we appreciate our nightmare scenarios here. Amanda Jones, I want to turn to you now. You've written about your struggle with parents and electeds to maintain access to books. Focusing on the stakes here, I want you to explain why this point, why this is so important, why access to books for children is, you know, has become such a central struggle for you and kind of your life.
Well, kind of what Ari was saying was about, you know, weaponizing disinformation and misinformation is what's happening with our books in our libraries and our society. We're seeing a huge push to silence voices, silence entire communities, and the threat against, you know, the First Amendment, free speech. Our libraries are under attack, and it seems like separate issues, but they're all the same. They're all the same people pushing the same things, misinformation, disinformation. There's, you know, a society, we're being led to a society that's being ruled by fear, like what Natalie said. Then there's like this hysteria that's happening, and libraries are the cornerstone of where you can go and find your accurate, valid information. And if you don't know where to look, you can ask your friendly neighborhood librarian to point you to the direction, in the right direction. We're trained on research, and we're seeing a huge push to devalue the profession, defund libraries, whether it's in schools or public libraries, because, you know, and I forget who said this quote, a dumbed down society is an easier led society. But, you know, what scares me the most about this push, not only, you know, the defunding and the devaluation of libraries and you know, librarians and library workers, is that if voices are silenced, these books that they want to ban, they're by authors, about characters, and for people from all walks of life, but about characters from historically marginalized communities. And they're trying to rewrite history. They're trying to say certain things didn't happen in the past, whitewashing things, or, well, they've been whitewashed. And we're trying to, anyone who tries to give accurate information is harassed. You know, voices are valuable, and they're trying to be silenced and stifled right now. And, you know, politics is not what I went into. It's not what I went into, but apparently now that's all I talk about. And I never thought, you know, as a school librarian, I'm a fifth and sixth grade middle school librarian. And I've become this accidental advocate, activist that is speaking out for intellectual freedom. But as I have gone through this journey of being targeted by Christian nationalists over the past 2.5 years, I see that it's all connected. And my eyes have been opened, and, you know, it's all been connected. Elections, stories, voices, everything is trying to be stifled. And if you, especially in rural Louisiana, if you speak out against that, you're harassed and defamed and attacked. And it's very important that we stand strong and provide children and the communities with accurate information. And everybody deserves to see themselves, their stories on the shelves in libraries. In my community, they'll say, one of our library board of control members said, the library should be for the majority and not minorities. And that just, I gasped when he said it out loud. Mm-hmm. I gasped because he himself is actually from a historically marginalized community, which mm-hmm. shocked me. But it's very important, and everybody pays taxes. You know, everybody's a part of the community and deserves to be represented. And so we've got to stand up for these attacks on our on the books and the stories and the people in our libraries, because libraries are for everyone.
So many of these fights are happening in our small towns. I've seen as a statewide reporter that it's been very difficult to track kind of where challenges to certain books are happening and at what time. It's just it's such a widespread phenomena. I find it very difficult to track. Can you tell me, you talk a little bit about why the kind of because this is happening in the at the local most level, right? Like why that adds an added challenge, right, to the kind of thinking about this these challenges?
So these people have been planning this for years. They've been planning this for years. And these attacks are, you know, people tend to see, to think that attacks on libraries and books and these stories, that'll never happen in my town, but it's happening everywhere. Big cities, little cities, little towns, red, blue, purple, whatever. And I lost track of what you tell me.
Talking about the because it is so local, yeah. It is hard to maybe to see sometimes.
It's local and they sneak things in. They'll slide it into library board of control meeting or a local governance or a school board. And it's very local and it's harder to fight at the local level because it's so widespread. There's thousands of these local battles happening all over. So how does an association like the American Library Association or Every Library or PEN America put out all of these little fires? It's almost impossible. It takes ground roots, grassroots efforts in local communities. And in all these communities, you don't always have somebody that's going to stand up and fight back. So they're winning in all of these local arenas, which is actually, I hate to give them credit, but it's actually kind of genius on their part that instead of doing something federally, they're doing all of these local pushes. My hope is that nationally we'll start seeing bills and things to protect the right to read. We see it popping up in several states. We need something nationwide to kind of stop this. But yeah, it's very local. And again, it doesn't matter, large cities, small towns, it's happening everywhere. I can tell you somebody that it's happening, a school librarian or a public librarian, where it's happening in their community in every single state in the United States. And it's very important to pay attention at the local level because they sneak it in. And if you're not paying attention, before you know it, they've passed legislation or they've banned hundreds of books.
Thank you. Hatice, I want to turn to you now. Zoom out for us. You're working on a novel looking at fascism, the rise of fascism in modern Germany. And I wanted you to try to connect some of the things that we've been talking about at the table today with that kind of what you're witnessing in your home country.
Okay, wow.
Thank you
for this amazing thing I have to do now. But actually, I can really connect with everything you said, even though I'm not from America and I'm from Germany. So but what I've noticed in Germany and in Europe in general, we look a lot at America and then we take bad ideas that you have and do them, like having people like Trump. Okay, many things he does are very strange, but I've seen that they start to think those are good ideas. Mm. Like, for example, I'm researching for my novel, like crazy things that they're saying. And one thing they said was they want to forbid like the AfD, which is the right wing party that is gaining more and more popularity in Germany. Maybe you heard of it. And they want to ban pizza, which I thought, for what? Are you crazy? No
one is going baked to into do the that. Crust, maybe.
And we have a very from Turkey a specific food. It's like kebab, but it's in a bun, and they also want that to be banned. And I thought, no one is going to do that. Nobody will say, okay, we just want schnitzel forever. That's not going to happen because people love this food. Why are you? what is so stupid? It's so stupid. We have the same with healthcare. They want to, like, especially they have like something they call Mediterranean migraine, which is when people like me go to the hospital and they say, oh, they're just Mediterranean migraine. They just pretend to be like sick. But we don't believe them so much. They don't tell you in your face, but things came out about it. Mm. They want to ban books for no reason, which is so stupid. I just can't. And especially they want to ban people like me to write books, especially about these things, because I'm very political. Also, I feel like I haven't chosen it. It just happened. And then I noticed, well, no one's doing it so much, so I have to do it, I guess. What I think what they did well is pretend to care a lot. Mm-hmm. Like, we have a thing called Schuldkult, which is like... it's like culture of feeling guilty, because we obviously feel very guilty for what happened during the Holocaust, and we have lots of museums in school. Everyone has to go to a concentration camp and look at it and be confronted with everything and do plays about it and read about it. We do a lot about the past, but we don't do a lot about the present. Mm. And since the 7th of October, there are so many mosques and synagogues being attacked. And I went for a research trip for my novel. I went to Halle, and Halle is where a guy thought, oh, I want to kill Jewish people for no reason. And he didn't get into the synagogue. It didn't happen. But I went there, and what I saw is that they still have to be protected since the 7th of October. They have to be protected by the police. There's always a police guard there. There's a van there because people want to still kill them. And we are good at maybe thinking about what we did in the past, but we're not good at protecting people that need to be protected right now in the present. And we have to do actually so much more about anti-Semitism. So just because it looks maybe like, oh, Germany is so good at like thinking about what we did in the past, maybe we're not so good at being good right now. And so in my novel, I am talking about, or what I'm researching right now is why. Like, I need to understand what is going on in your brain. Why are you doing this? So it's like what I found out so far is what I also see a lot in Trump. It's not like a fact-based politic strategy. It's always about feeling. It's always about, we have the feeling that you take our jobs away. We have the feeling that you eat cats and dogs. We don't know that, but it looks like that. So we're just going to convey this feeling of anger, of fear. And so people are emotionally abounded with all these negative things. Mm. And that's what the AfD is also doing. They're also making you feel like people like me are going to come and take your job away from you. And I don't want your job. I'm a writer. Don't worry. And they think we're going to take over your culture and we're going to take over everything. And they just have a fear-based politics and it's never based on facts. If you would challenge them based on facts, they're just going to go back to the feeling. Mm-hmm. So that's what I've noticed. And they're like always angry. For what? I don't know. So I'm trying to find that out. So I want to talk to you later.
Did you have a follow up you wanted to add?
Well, I have to understand why no pizza. Why they're banning? Because they're going to start banning donuts here.
What?
I'm making a joke.
Don't give them the idea. All right.
Well, the quote was, they don't want like multicultural whatever. They want, this is Germany. Yeah. We need to be Germany, not Italy.
Yeah. Mm. So stupid.
It's very stupid. It's the dumbest thing ever, but it's great for my book. It will be so funny.
So we're really lucky with this panel to have so much diverse expertise present. I want to leave some time for the last 20 minutes to chat about, for you to ask questions. We'll have a mic coming around shortly to ask your questions. While you're kind of thinking about what you want to ask our great panel here, Ari, I wanted to return to you. You drew a distinction in your book between institutional and electoral coups, right? A structure I'm finding, it felt really, when I read it, I felt like very pertinent to this moment. And I wanted you to explain to the audience kind of that distinction, where that lives.
So one of the things that I think has become really alarming, and it gets back to what you were saying, Amanda, about the libraries, but one of the things that Trump has done, that Trump didn't invent this, but I think Trump took it to a new level, is trying to corrupt previously nonpartisan institutions and trying to take them from institutions that would help all Americans to institutions that would only benefit him and his supporters. So think about what he did to the post office, right? I mean, the post office quite literally delivers the mail. So it's something that everybody relies on. But once Trump realized that we were in a pandemic and that people were going to vote by mail and that Democrats were going to vote by mail more than Republicans for the first time in U.S. history, because Democrats took COVID more seriously than Republicans, then he started changing the post office, right? And putting a Republican mega donor in as head of the post office, which had never been done before. And it felt like they were deliberately trying to sabotage the post office, which was one of the oldest American institutions. The first postmaster general was Ben Franklin. So, I mean, it literally dates back to the founding of the country. Same thing with the 2020 census. The census, quite literally, is supposed to count every person in America, not count every American, to your point earlier, but to count every person in America. And what Trump wanted to do is say that we don't want to count undocumented people, because even though they are supposed to be counted in the census, they don't have a right to be here. Thus, they shouldn't be counted. Or we don't want to count people who weren't born here, things like that. So they tried to do changing the questions on the census and cut the funding for the census so that it would count fewer people of color, fewer people from immigrant communities. And again, the census is the sixth sentence of the Constitution is the 2020 census, because the founders realized that it was incredibly important to have an accurate count of who was in the country so they could do things like decide who gets roads, who gets schools, how many politicians did people get. This is, again, one of the oldest things we've ever done as a country. They sent people around on horseback in 1790 to count people on the census. So what Trump did is he started to politicize these previously nonpartisan institutions. Then that really laid the groundwork for what he did in terms of trying to overturn the election, right? Because once he realized, oh, I can take over these nonpartisan institutions, well, that's not a big gap to saying that, okay, if I've done it to the post office, if I've done it to the census, then I'm going to do it to elections as well, right? And I'm going to change things from just the counting of ballots, which had been done by no matter what party you were in. If you worked the polls, you counted the votes, right? And he was saying, no, if the votes are cast for the wrong person, then I'm not going to count them. And so I think that we're seeing it on multiple fronts right now, and they go together, right? Because the institutional coups, the institutional capture has a political purpose, right? It's being done for political reasons. And I would argue it's being done to try to limit democracy for people that they don't want to participate in the democratic process, not just in terms of voting, but broadly how we think of democracy, whether it's free expression or it's free assembly or a lot of these rights that we thought were guaranteed, but are now being restricted.
Please.
You know, I'd like to add on that, because, you know, we're seeing the demonization of the American Library Association. And who is standing in the way of these efforts to ban and censor books? Librarians and the American Library Association. So what we, you know, American Library Association has been around forever. Nonpartisan, like, you know, our biggest push is that libraries are for everyone. And because librarians refuse to back down, you're seeing all of these bills to, have states pull away from the American Library Association. So it's the same thing.
Thank you very much. Does anybody have any questions? I'm going to grab the mic and bring it to you.
Kia ora, my name is Chris. I'm a visiting writer from New Zealand. We've had an election recently, and we voted in a right-wing government made up of three parties. We're calling them the Coalition of Chaos. What's been interesting is how blatant a lot of their actions are. You know, they're doing things where there is clear conflicts of interest. The supporting lobby groups like the tobacco industry and the gun lobby in New Zealand. What do you think has sort of led to this point where we have not only small groups that are sort of trying to ban books in libraries, but we actually have senators, politicians, and ministers, leaders of countries that are emboldened to just do all of this out in the public so blatantly?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll say, speaking of doing it all out in the open so publicly, our U.S. Representative Clay Higgins from Louisiana I'm so embarrassed. He tweeted out, I mean, he boldly stated on Twitter that one day all of our libraries will be privately church run.
Wow.
You know? So they're very emboldened and they're not hiding it. It's just, I struggle with wondering why everybody else can't see it, especially in my small town. And if you say that these are all connected and they're doing this out in the open, I'm a conspiracy theorist or I'm woke or whatever. But it sells, you know, fear and hysteria and all of it all sells, and it keeps them in power because they create this hysteria so they can swoop into these with solutions to these problems that we don't actually have, you know, so that they can remain in power. It's greed and power, and they don't want to lose control. So they create this, you know, these conspiracies.
I think one reason we're seeing right-wing movements be so successful, even in previously very tolerant places, is there's a lot of things they have in common, right? One is a fear of changing demographic groups getting new rights and new political power. We're certainly seeing that throughout Europe. Another is the breakdown of traditional media and the rise of social media, in which there's very few gatekeepers to fact check information. So the decline of local news, the decline of trusted news, that is a phenomenon that's happening across the country. And then I think, you know, concerted efforts to try to empower right-wing parties across the country, where, you know, Steve Bannon is trying to take the Trump show on the road. And he's not necessarily taking it to Zealand, right? But he's very consciously tried to take it to Germany and to Italy and to France and the UK. And then that sort of spills over to other places. And so I think sometimes it's comforting to feel like what's happening in America is not unprecedented, but I think America has been key in sort of pushing these things to the right. And I think, you know, the counterbalance of it is just basically a question of whether or not we embrace multiracial democracy or not, because I think that's an issue throughout the world now. A lot of places are looking more like America looks right now in terms of the population changing. And, you know, America, for a lot of its flaws, has embraced multiracial democracy, at least in the last 40 or 50 years. And now we're starting to turn our back on it. And that's having ramifications in a lot of other places as well.
From what I noticed in Germany is they feel super safe. Nothing ever happens to them. If they do something bad, which is actually against the law, well, okay, pay this fee. Then it's fine. So they feel safe to just continue doing it. And that's my take on it. Mm-hmm. I wanted to say something else, but I forgot. I'm sorry. Maybe it'll come to me. I'll tell you later.
I had a question. Maybe Nina, you could talk to this, but I'm interested in how climate change and the, you know, more prevalence of, you know, a toxic world, how that might impact. I know this is going kind of to a different field of things, but I'm kind of curious if you think that that will change the perspective of people in a political system or in power, because maybe it's just me, but, you know, I feel like more and more people are dealing with some kind of condition of some sort, mm-hmm. and are looking for ways to ameliorate their health. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if the political situation, you know, like in Florida, there's climate denial or climate change denial. And so does that impact also political systems? Do you think that maybe that will shift people towards working together in some way, or dissolution of healthcare systems, things like that?
I couldn't tell if you said dissolution or the solution, because I feel like both feel like possibilities.
So, okay. So like breaking apart.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I like it a lot. I think there's several parallels between what you're talking about with climate change, climate resiliency, and what is happening in healthcare. I think one of the things that comes top to mind for me is urgency and understanding the urgency. And we understand the urgency when it happens to us or when it happens to people that we love, both in when we're talking about environmental changes, climate change, whatnot, but also health and our own bodies. Like it's easy to be healthy. It's not easy to be sick or to be unwell, especially if that's chronic and especially if it's something that doesn't kill you. One of the things that I have come to understand a little bit more in the chronic illness world is people, unless it happens to you, people are really good at just sort of putting it over there and doubting if it's happening, which was a word I heard you use as well. Yeah, I think there's potential. I think there's possibility. And I think the more that these things that happen slowly and kind of move their way through people and through communities of people, that is both really terrifying, but I think it's hopeful in terms of change. We were talking a little bit earlier about grassroots change happening and that really having a domino effect. So it can go up as well as going down. So I hope so. I hope there's solution and not dissolution.
I haven't really seen, whole states have been wiped out, North Carolina. I don't see suddenly everyone believes in climate change. They just, and it's frankly, it nauseates me a little where they say, oh, we all gathered together and helped each other. Yeah, for a moment, and then we forget about it. When we're scared, when things are really right over our head, and then we forget about it. And that's what's disturbing. And people have used that like a hurricane. Oh, everyone gathered together. Yeah, for that minute, and then it's over. And I don't really see that. That's what's so frightening to me, is human beings are very thick and stubborn. And Americans, excuse me, I happen to love the land, but we're very comfortable compared to most places, and we don't budge. We're just not budging. I hate to say that. I mean, I've worked with people for 50 years.
I was going to say, maybe in Germany, I don't know whether there was always such a consciousness of recycling and health and things like that. So is that changing?
I mean, the party, the AfD, is trying to also be like, it's not real, no climate change. But in Germany, many things are actually happening, like lots of places are flooding. So I think we're still more aware, maybe, because I've noticed here there isn't so much recycling, which I found crazy when I came here. I thought, oh my God, I feel so bad because I have to use this paper cup the whole time when I'm using it so many times until it's falling apart. Because I feel so bad, because I'm used to not doing that in Germany. But it could be better, 100% could be better still. Yeah.
Hello. Hi. Thank you for this brilliant panel. My name is Sabine. I'm also one of the IWP visiting writers. I'm originally from Pakistan, and it's interesting for me to listen to this because growing up, when I would travel, and I've lived in many places, when I would say I'm from Pakistan, people would say, oh, you're, you know, from this country with dictatorship and political uncertainty, and, you know, they'd be like, oh my God. Now when I tell people, oh, I'm in America right now, they say, oh my God, you know, what's going to happen there? So it's interesting to see this contrast. So my question, I mean, I think you know, many of you have already touched upon it, is that having lived in many different places, I do find that, you know, we seem to be moving in these circles. The liberals will talk to the liberals, the conservatives will talk to the conservatives. So as writers, how can we be that bridge? How can we get people to listen, to change our minds? I know you just said that, you know, people are stubborn, but it also makes me think that, you know, yes, everything is political, but everything also exists on this notion of hope, whether we are trying to fight climate change, whether we are, you know, aiming for political stability or for humanities. So how can, as writers, we be the change that bridges the gap between these minds? So if you could maybe comment on that.
I'll say, so in my book, I wrote about book banning, but I tried to bridge the gap because there's a lot of disinformation out there about book bans and censorship. And so when I wrote it for people in the middle, people like my parents. Well, I wouldn't say my parents are in the middle, but I wrote it for people that, you know, believe in hope and want to know the truth. Now, I can't force anybody to read it, but in my community, they have been. And it's very important to get the truth out in valid sources. So when I wrote, I was writing about how libraries really operate. This is the truth. This is, and then we follow the money and why this is happening. But a lot of times the truth is lacking. And it goes back to, you know, the question about climate change too. It's all connected because they're trying to stifle books about climate change and books about mental health and being zen and socially emotional learning. And all we can do is push out the truth and hope that people read it, as at least as a writer. If, you know, activist side is a little different, but, you know, my hope is that people would read my book and say, you know, these libraries should be nonpartisan. It should be for everyone. And you know, we have to be the calm in the storm because there's so much hate being pushed, especially not just as a writer, but as a school librarian, as an educator. I forget who it was that said they pretend to care a lot. Someone on here said, I think you said people pretend to care a lot, but if they really cared, we'd be focusing on issues that really mattered. There's too much hysteria and misinformation floating around. So I just tried to push out the truth in my book. Whether that came across, I don't know. I tried.
Well, I think it gets back to having a shared set of facts and values. And that's really what's broken down, I think, in a lot of places in recent years. And so I think we have to figure out a way to rebuild that. I think people are becoming a lot smarter, for example, about the downsides of social media. There was a lot of utopian rhetoric about how democratic this was going to make things. And it's been, by and large, a disaster in terms of democratization. It may have democratized the medium, but it didn't actually help democratize society. What it did is emboldened a lot of bad actors in a lot of places, and a lot of greed behind it. And I think now, to me, it's if without those kind of shared values, things start to break down. And then the question is sort of who you're writing for, because I don't think you can write for everybody, right? Unless you're James Patterson or something like that. You know, you're not writing for everybody. And if you are, you're probably having to dumb it down a lot, quite frankly, if you're trying to reach everybody. Maybe people disagree on that. But generally speaking, you look at the most popular books that are sold, the books that sell 30 million copies, right? Some of them are good. Most of them are bad, I would say. And so, for example, what I do, you know, I report on elections, right? And one of the things, one of the dominant storylines in America for the last 4 years is how can we change the mind of the people that believe the election is stolen? And the question is, you can't. You cannot change their minds because they're operating at a completely different level of facts. But they are a minority faction in the country. So the question is, should I spend my time writing for the 65% of Americans who believe the election was not stolen, or should I try to convince the 35% of people who believe the election was stolen? I would rather try to give the pro-democracy majority in the country accurate information and embolden them to defend democracy, as opposed to trying to persuade people who will never be persuaded to try to change their minds. Now, would it be great if 100% of Americans believe the election was not stolen? Absolutely, right? That would be the ideal scenario. But if you have to make trade-offs as a writer, I would rather figure out where can I actually do the most good, as opposed to feeling like I'm fighting some battle that might be valiant, but ultimately is going to be unsuccessful no matter what I do.
I'm thinking back to the Natalie Goldberg quote that we started with pretty early in the panel about how abstraction is necessary for violence. And if people were more specific and had a daily writing practice, perhaps that would lead to more peace. And I'm thinking about a lot of the oppressive legislation in our state, but elsewhere, and how vague it is, how much abstraction is in those laws. So we're told you can't have books that include such and such, but not given a specific list of books to ban. So it causes a lot of chaos for people in schools and people in libraries to try to figure that out themselves. We're told you can't do DEI, but without any of the terms defined exactly what we are and aren't allowed to do. We're told trans kids can't use the bathroom, but not told who is enforcing that and how, and what would the punishment be if they did just use the bathroom. So I'm thinking about how the specificity is pushed off onto the very people who are impacted by this legislation to like figure it out for themselves, what they think their oppressors want from them, right? So I'm wondering if any of you have any thoughts about potentially effective strategies, either in making things more specific, in putting the demand for specificity back onto the legislators, or in like dwelling in the abstraction and maybe flying below the radar.
That's a great question.
Great questions need great answers. Don't be shy.
I do feel like one of the things I've tried to do in my work to address that, or address part of that, because there was a lot of really great stuff happening in that question, is to be specific and to use language to show the lack of other language when we fail to have proper terms or a proper diagnosis for people, when we can't even come to a common agreement on what it means to have these certain conditions. That's not just dismissive. It leads to people not receiving the care that they need. It goes on to isolation. It affects people in so many different ways. So I think that specificity for me, I try to reveal that in the lack of language that we have around healthcare and what that tells us.
Yeah, I think you're right about the vagueness being part of the point, because when it becomes more specific, it's harder to defend. For example, when Florida said that you had to teach slavery as a common good, right? That was crazy, right? And so that was a tangible example of the kind of educational censorship, right? And then you couldn't even have the governor who was trying to do it defend it anymore because it was so crazy. So the vaguer they make it, the harder it is to then defend why they're doing it in the first place. So I think that's a good point. I think it's also a way to maybe fight back against these kind of things, is show who's impacted by it, but also what it could ultimately lead to, right? Like, because I think one of the things that people think about is, oh, it's not going to affect me, right? It's only going to affect that trans kid, right? Or this person or that person. But once you realize, like, okay, well, they're not just coming for that person, they're coming for all of these other things too, then it starts to be something that you can mobilize more people around.
I think, you know, they're purposely vague because fear and uncertainty is the point.
Yeah.
Because you overcorrect. So they'll just with books, you know, censorship laws, they've passed legislation in multiple states where librarians can be criminalized for certain books. Well, people are so scared of being put into jail for books that they're overcorrecting, and we're seeing soft censorship. So now we're not even ordering, some librarians, not me, are not even ordering the books anymore. And so they overcorrect, because you look at the horror stories, like a teacher in Oklahoma who shared a QR code for the New York Public Library got her teaching license removed a couple weeks ago. You know, strategies, I would love to know some strategies. The only thing I've seen effective so far has been lawsuits. And then the average citizen, like, we don't have money.
But I will say, you know, there have been a lot of places in swing districts where the people that wanted to censor education have been defeated. So I think maybe you're being a little too pessimistic about the fight back, because this has backfired in a lot of places. There used to be particularly a very strong belief in this country that people should be able to do what they want, right? The mind your own damn business thing that Tim Walz talks about. That is not a liberal idea. That was for many years a conservative idea. So I think in terms of defending free speech, defending free expressions, I mean, these are bedrock principles in the Bill of Rights, in the Constitution. It should not be hard to defend the idea that even if you disagree with something, people should be allowed to do it. That is one of the most, if not the most, American idea there is in our country.
A spark of optimism. Thank you all for joining us. Give our panel a hand. This has been the Politics Panel.